So here you are at my radio door. I love your costumes, and so therefore, I have some tricks, and furthermore, some guests who are treats. That's for sure. Welcome to Spectrum West, folks. I'm Al Ross. Fun show today. Susie Boggess has been around the music scene for a few decades now, and she made quite a mark on the country charts over those years. Well, she's walking on stage at the Mabel Tainter Sunday evening and will provide the audience with what she's known for and a little bit more. She'll talk about that a little later on. She's also appearing, by the way, in Hayward on Saturday night. John Hildebrand is a master of describing where he's been and who he's met along the way. His latest book is called Long Way Round, Through the Heartland by River. And he'll recount the trip that provided the material and the memories. And of course, it wouldn't be Halloween without something a bit weird. So B.J. Hollers has another book to help us celebrate. Like many of his to come before, the topic is a bit unexpected, but certainly appreciated. It's called Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. The UW Eau Claire English mentor stopped by on Monday to tell us all about it. Now, your book topics are all over the road, from segregation to race relations to extinct birds to what dogs are thinking, personal experiences, and in the description of This Is Only a Test, it says, tornadoes, drownings, and nuclear catastrophes force him to acknowledge the inexplicable while he attempts to overcome his greatest fear, the impossibility of protecting his newborn son from the world's cruelties. So how old's that newborn son from which this quote was taken?
Yeah, seems a bit dated now. He is 7 years old.
Well, see, there you go.
There you go.
And now you are on the verge of adding to your dependence. So in addition to being a down-to-earth guy, you also like things that might actually be hanging out above the earth. You like monsters and weird things. And it being Halloween, where did that inclination come from? An early age?
I think it was an early age. You know, I think especially there's a time in your life, maybe you're 7, 8, 9, 10, where you just can't get enough of this stuff. I just kind of have that arrested development situation going on. But my mom took my brother and me to Pauline, Ohio in the summer of 1996 to visit a crop circle. I was 12 years old. I'd been kind of watching X-Files. I knew a little bit about this stuff. I'd seen Independence Day in the theaters 5 times that summer. Ooh. So I was very into this. And so she drove us across state borders and we checked it out. And I think that really had an indelible impression on me. You know, here's something in my own backyard I couldn't quite put a finger on.
So now at the top of page 63 of your book, you ask the question, am I steering readers on versions further removed from the truth? Adding an echo chamber that's already deafening. What could I possibly know that past scholars didn't? What new clue in a new context might change everything?
It's something that really concerns me, you know, as a writer. It's easy to kind of regurgitate and repeat what other people have said, but I think you have to really get out there and try to contribute something new to the conversation. And so that was always the tricky part of this book, is finding that new kernel of evidence or looking at something from a new perspective to kind of see the case file, so to speak, in a whole new light.
Because you go out and you do a lot of visiting and things, but you don't and can't come to conclusions. And if you don't come to conclusions, then what you've done is added to the legend.
Exactly. And that can be useful in its own way. But there were a couple moments in this book where I found something a little different. And that was, I guess, the real joy of it.
I came to wonder if there are Mothmen and werewolves. And if there are they into technology? Do they have a Twitter account? But then I thought to myself, if you are Mothman and you are a werewolf. Now, werewolves, they don't turn into werewolves until the moon's full. And is Mothman always a Mothman? So in other words, he couldn't at any time waltz in and get a smartphone.
That might be difficult for him, yeah.
He didn't just turn into Mothman when he was around a bright light or something.
It's my understanding that once a Mothman, always a Mothman. But on that point of trying to bring something new to the story, that's actually one of the case files where I found something different. Ah. And it came from the bird book I'd written previously. I'd had some opportunity to look at old Christmas counts from Audubon's from the events where we do mm-hmm. these Christmas bird counts, and I found a couple reported sightings of a sandhill crane in that very region. And so there had already been some theories about Mothman might just be a sandhill crane, but there'd never been any evidence of sandhill cranes in that region.
That seems so far-fetched to me.
You know what?
I've seen sandhill cranes. How do you make Mothman into that?
Well, is it more far-fetched than Mothman himself is the question, you know?
Okay. So let's hit a more happy note.
Sure.
Your book uses one of my favorite words at least twice. And that is antediluvian. From the day I learned that word in senior English in high school, I have, through the years, searched for ways and times to use that word. Seldom have I come up with it, and you put it in a book twice.
I owe it all to Oscar the Giant Turtle. He's the second case file in the book, Cherubusco, Indiana, 1949. An enormous turtle, some say 500 pounds, big as a dining room table, alleged to have been seen in this small town. And let me tell you, as far as opportunities to use the word antediluvian, he really helped me out on that front.
And if you're going to make a giant turtle into a monster or a legend, why name it Oscar?
There are a lot of theories. You know, there are a couple names. The newspaper came up with two names. You have a couple options here. It's from Cherubusco, Indiana, so some called it the Beast of Busco.
There you are.
Has a nice alliterative ring
better,
to it.
Yeah.
That's not bad. And Oscar allegedly was named after some of the big wigs in town. There's a couple of them, both of whom were named Oscar. So allegedly one of the Oscars from the people in town got the namesake for the turtle.
Okay.
Yes.
Enjoying some time with B.J. Hollers, author of many books. This one, because it's Halloween, and his latest is Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. As the author of this book, what is your role? Are you investigative reporter? Are you janitor cleaning up after everyone else? Or interpreter of how and why we find ourselves fascinated with legends? Because this book is as much about human nature as it is about the supernatural.
That's exactly it. And that's sort of the big secret of the book. That's sort of the open secret. Yeah, it's kind of wrapped in this idea of the mysterious and monsters and Martians and all of these weird phenomena, but really it's about people and it's about place, and in particular how small towns, especially in the Midwest, when those towns and those town people embrace their strange, they benefit economically, they benefit culturally, and so sometimes the monster is simply the vehicle to find ways for these stories to persist.
I know the Ten Commandments, and I think the first commandment should have been keep an open mind.
I'm with you. You know, there's a great phrase in here from one of the women I interviewed. She says, I like to keep my mind as open as possible without my brain falling out. And I'm in the same boat.
Now, BJ, I have a daughter who's been in Eagle River for several years. She's a nurse there. I called her about the pancake aliens thing. She sent an old video of the guy being interviewed about the encounter. It's on YouTube.
Joe Simonton, yes.
He was a plumber, wasn't he?
He was very clear about this point. Joe Simonton was, in fact, a plumber. When he finally got the airtime, he said he wanted to set the record straight, and everyone thought he was going to talk about the aliens, and he said, I am not a chicken farmer, I am a plumber. That was him setting the record straight. He was very proud of his plumbing work. But he has a really wild story, too.
And the aliens made him pancakes. He handed them to him out the door.
That's his story. They needed some water. He gave him some water. In exchange, they gave him four pancakes. He ate one, didn't love it, but that's not even the weird part. The weird part of the story is that the Air Force got involved. They confiscated the remaining pancakes.
There was buckwheat in them.
There was buckwheat in them.
So they landed somewhere where there was buckwheat.
Either that or they had some locally sourced food right here on Earth.
So now we're kind of chuckling at this, and yet you ran across people, they just don't chuckle. Right. And one of the guys is Val Johnson, who, whenever he hears Jerry Lee Lewis sing Great Balls of Fire, he has a reaction that's different than most of ours. He is an encounter that has the most clues. I mean, he was injured, his car was damaged, and we're talking UFOs here, folks. And yet, he shrugs his shoulders about it. And you found that a little bit bewildering.
In a good way, yeah.
Okay.
What's so cool about Val Johnson is that he often says, you know, I don't know what it was. It's beyond my pay grade. I'm just telling you what happened.
And the story quickly.
Sure. The short version is on August of 1979, near Oslo, Minnesota, the sheriff's deputy named Val Johnson was out for a ride in his car. A strange ball of light hit his windshield without breaking it, but cracking it in a very strange way. Mm. It went through the car. It left some burn marks on him. And the weirdest part is there's something like 14 lost minutes, both on his wristwatch and on the clock with in the car.
Yes.
It's just an incredible story. And the reason there's so many clues left behind is because there's so much physical evidence. And so that's often thought of as a top 10 UFO sighting, even though Val himself doesn't know what it was or even venture a guess.
Did we get the bureaucrats involved in this one too?
You know, there were some people from the Center of UFO Studies near Chicago that came. They had all their equipment, you know, and they don't know either. You know,
there was a big Air Force base in South Dakota, North Dakota.
There's the Minot Air Force Base not far away in North Dakota, and that has its own strange story. But yeah, there's another Air Force Base up the road too. And so that's a lot of these kind of UFO related situations often do happen to occur around not only Air Force bases, but especially nuclear sites as well.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I know.
A quote I read, remain disciplined, remain scholarly as a defense for ridicule. You were kind of a Johnny-come-lately to these things, weren't you? I mean, you show up in town and people go, oh, wow, somebody is still writing about this. Your take was a human one, so it was different. So
I'm a Johnny-come-lately to almost all my subjects. I kind of roll in there and hope I can hear the story and get something different from them. And that's the tricky part, especially in a small town. Who's this outside guy who's coming in wanting our story? So you got to be really mindful about earning that trust.
Now, it appears from the bibliography in the book that keeping track of sources for a book like this is almost as involved as writing the book itself. You are a hardliner for research.
I love it. I love it.
What did it take to do that? What did you do? You took trips. Mm-hmm. You wanted to visit these places. Did you set weeks aside, this is book research, or was this done over the course of years?
Over the course of a solid year, kind of a piecemeal place to place. It's tricky. The book's made up of 9 what I'm calling case files, and so in some ways it felt like writing 9 small books. You have to go so deep into each of the chapters that by the time you finish one onto the next, you kind of got to start from scratch and try all over again.
How did you pick the subjects of this book? Because there are sightings and weird things. I know downright weird people. If you had told me you were writing a book, I could have sent you to them.
And that might be the sequel. No, you bring up a great question. And for me, it was a matter of a couple things. I really wanted to focus on stories that weren't terribly well known. So you're not going to find a lot of Bigfoot in this book. Everyone knows Bigfoot. Everyone knows the Loch Ness Monster. I wanted to look at lesser known creatures and phenomena because it offered new and fresh terrain for me to explore. Mm-hmm. And what I found again and again is there's only so much in the written record, but the oral tradition, going to these small town diners or cafes or museums and talking to people, that's where the real stories live.
Going back to Eagle River, the one story that people all know there is the light up in the woods that's up in the UP. That's an ongoing thing, and people drive up there all the time to see if they can see that weird light.
The Paulding Lights, right? Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But now the guy with the pancakes, yeah. I think people just go, eh.
They're quick. We're quick to dismiss things we don't understand, even if it's as silly as pancake.
Was there a time when Eagle River took advantage of this? Did they have drive-ins with alien pancakes? Did you find that out?
You know, it's my understanding, kind of looking at the old news reports, there wasn't a lot of benefit from this story. A lot of folks in Eagle River didn't really embrace it fully. There's not a lot of kitsch and paraphernalia to sell. And even Joe Simonton himself really kind of paid a price with his reputation for even daring to share the story at all.
The other thing that I noticed, and I had to ask you the question because you brought it out at least one point in the book, whereby you placed a phone call to one of the Air Force bases and never got a call back. Did that happen to you a lot? Were you contacted people and you never heard back from them and you had to just drop that?
There were certain cases I was really hoping I would go down that rabbit hole when I was starting this book, one being Elmwood right up the road, you know, and Elmwood, of course, is famous for trying to get this landing strip for UFOs, and I just couldn't get the right sources, couldn't get the right people, and so sometimes you have to kind of reroute your own trajectory.
Now, the epilogue in the book contains some wonderful quotes, some very philosophical, some you read a few times to digest their true meaning, some you say to yourself, I have to remember and use that one, knowing you never will. And there's one that stood out to me as being the ultimate summary. It's a tricky business knowing who to trust.
Yeah.
That's almost a life lesson there.
And it applies to so many things, right? I mean, in this book, I kind of put my horse to all kinds of wagons, so to speak, you know, and you really want to be careful about who you trust and whose voices you project and what that means for you. You know, if one person decided to really mislead me, and that would reflect on me. And so far, I'm pretty confident with the people I worked with, but that trust didn't come easily, and it took a lot of vetting. And the biggest vetting I could do was when I approached people, if people were really gung-ho to talk to me, I was a little leery. But when people were a little hesitant, wanted to kind of know me and the project a little better before they signed on, those were the people I felt I could trust. And so I kind of used that line of logic for most of my interviewees. They're taking a real risk just by telling these stories, you know, so I could respect that. And even if I disagreed with perhaps what I think they may have seen in some instances, I could still respect certainty that they saw what they believed they saw.
You know what's going to happen now, don't you?
I don't know. You tell me.
Because you wrote this book, you're going to have an encounter of some kind. the supernatural powers out there are saying, you know, while BJ was out doing this, I sensed he was in disbelief, I think. We have to give him some proof.
And, you know, I'm looking for a sequel to write, so I'm looking forward to that opportunity.
Would you go for that?
If I saw it, if I explored it, I have to be very mindful. You know, I mean, as a professor, I often feel I'm riding a very careful line. You know, I did an interview at Central Time not too long ago, and he asked me, what do people say to you at faculty meetings? And it raised a really good point, you know, and of course, I have very supportive faculty people in my department. But at the same time, this is research that's sort of different than what we're expected to do. Or for me, it's always about culture and people and the stories they share and how to give voice to those stories.
So your next one is wonderful. It's you and DeSun on a road trip. What are you thinking about in the strange department? It would be enough to say, I have a few things that I'm thinking about, Al.
I'll let a little cat out of the bag, and there's really nothing to it yet, just the earliest kernel of an idea. But this coming summer, a colleague and I are teaching a class on King Arthur in England. And so in anticipation of that class, I've been up since 5 a.m. watching documentaries and reading books and trying to figure out how do these myths and realities come to life in these sorts of international stories as well.
Was he a good guy or a bad guy?
Depends on who you ask and at what point in his life you're asking about it. Yeah. He did some wonderful things, allegedly, or at least the mythic. But yeah, there were some things I don't necessarily approve of, including, well, maybe leave it at that. Well, you'll read the book and learn all about his darker side, too.
Old Art. He was a character, wasn't
Old
he?
Art.
Yeah. BJ Hollers, thanks.
Thank you.
The books of BJ Hollers, wherever good books are sold. Next, author John Hildebrand's latest adventure, and later on, Susie Boggess charms us with her music and her personality. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Simply Dunn in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space for events. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery and fair trade gifts. More at simply-dunn.com. Support also comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information is available at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory, presenting the painter Naomi Terry Salgado, photographer Earl Duckett, jewelry designer Diane Keeler, and glassblower Polly Cudd. More at artzgallery.org. Hey, there's a lot of theatrical activity going on. Here's Jim Oliver.
Thank you, sir. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Duck Hunter Shoots Angel November 7th through the 10th and the 14th through the 16th in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Pippi Longstocking will be presented by the Eau Claire Children's Theater Friday through Sunday at the Oxford Theater. Beauty and the Beast will be staged Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. Curtain time is 7 p.m. Friday, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, and 2 p.m. Sunday. The Neillsville Area Players will present It's a Wonderful Life Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and the following Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the Neillsville High School Auditorium. Robin Hood will be staged by the University of Wisconsin River Falls Theater Friday and Saturday, and the following Friday and Saturday in the Davis Theater at the University. The University of Wisconsin Eau Claire Players show Reefer Madness will be presented tonight, if you're listening on Thursday, through Saturday in the Riverside Theater at the University. Singing in the Rain will be presented by the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. as well as Sundays at 2 p.m. through November the 17th. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will hold auditions for Bridge to Terabithia at 5:30 p.m. November the 10th and the 11th in the Oxford Theater. Auditions for Ashana Madel, a pretty girl, will be held Thursday, November the 7th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. and Saturday, November 9th from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Auditions for Little Women have been scheduled by the Barron Spotlighters from 5 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, November the 12th and 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, November the 16th in the Barron Area Community Center. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Spectrum West on WPR. Another book I had the pleasure of reading lately came from yet another UW Eau Claire educator, Professor Emeritus John Hildebrand. An avid outdoors person, he took a trip on a somewhat circular system of rivers that can allow a mariner, or canoeist in this case, to see a whole lot of the state from the water. As in BJ's book, he too learned a lot about human nature. The book has a water theme right from the get-go. I mean, the intro is titled Headwaters.
I divide the book into eight different rivers, but I needed something separate to explain two primary questions. Why me? Why here? Why was I going on this trip? And for me, Headwaters, it's the source. It explains, at least the opening chapter, why I'm doing what I'm doing.
There is a circle one can make. This is by way of defining the book utilizing rivers in Wisconsin, Round River. It doesn't mean that one can just sit back and allow the water to carry you, as in paddle to the sea. You have to work to get where you're going. Tell us how this trip materialized. A bucket list thing or something you'd always thought of? What?
No, actually, I hadn't thought about it. I had thought about, particularly with the divisive politics in the state, the need to reacquaint myself with the state that's not connected by interstate, small towns, rural areas, which I felt that I had, even though I've lived in Wisconsin for 40 years, didn't really know or hadn't kept up with.
Mm-hmm.
So how to do that? And it struck me that one way to do it was by river. And I remember reading this essay by Aldo Leopold called The Round River, in which he states right at the beginning, Wisconsin not only had a round river, Wisconsin is one. You know, he was talking about ecology. He was writing metaphorically, and I thought, you know, literally, you could make a round river if you just, you know, canoed down some rivers and up others and, you know, portage or car portage. You could make an all-river route through the state. So looking at a map and a little imagination, that's how I came up with the idea for the trip.
You begin on the Chippewa River, you hit the Mississippi and the excitement that can bring, both in scenery and competing watercraft. Then you head up the Wisconsin, take a right onto the Fox, then the Bad River, the Brule, St. Croix, and back down the Mississippi at places like Lake Pepin and the Garden of Eden. I've always thought that story about the Garden of Eden around Trempealeau was interesting, although I've sort of discounted it because aren't we led to believe that there were fig leaves involved? And that doesn't make sense there.
Not in Trempealeau County. I think the climate's not right for fig trees.
No.
I remembered hearing about that book and then reading it. You can actually read it online. The State Historical Society has it. It was by a fellow named Reverend David Van Slyke's itinerant preacher, and I forget exactly the date, sometime in the 1880s, I think. Mm-hmm. He wrote this treatise, The Garden of Eden Found, and by golly, the Garden of Eden turned out to be near Galesville, where he was from. And the book, his treatise, is sort of an argument how if you bend Genesis a little bit, you can make the rivers of the Bible into the rivers feeding in the Mississippi. But mainly I like the idea of Eden, you know, what is paradise. The way I think about it is how do we find the place that is our Eden, where we're happy, where we feel like we belong? What does it take? And that's sort of a question that I've kind of pursued in a lot of my books.
This book was about what you were going to encounter, but at the heart of the adventure was the who you were going to encounter, those living and those gone but legendary, John Muir, Aldo Leopold, plus some big fish in small ponds that you ran into. I found it interesting when you were trying to find that shack. Was it Leopold's shack?
Leopold's shack.
And you couldn't locate it, and then someone said you're close.
Right. A river trip, maybe any trip, depends on serendipity. I knew that I wanted to see Leopold's shack because Leopold had been important to me, and I wanted to get there by water, and I couldn't find it. I was close. You know, I'm standing up in the canoe at this point. paddling gondolier style, looking over the bank, hoping to see the shack. Woman comes down her dock from her cottage and says hello. And I said, you know, do you know where this is? Oh, yeah, it's just behind that big birch tree. And I went looking for it. Still couldn't find it. Finally ran into a fellow who works for the Leopold Foundation named Dakota Johnson. And he not only took me to the shack, he took me in it. It looks like it hasn't changed, like Leopold just shut the door and walked away.
How big is it? Let's try to make a mental image here.
It's about the size of this office. And, you know, there's something about making a pilgrimage to a place that you've only read about. You imagine it. And very often things are smaller than you imagine. But this was really small. And yet so much of the way we think about nature, the outdoors, has been influenced by Leopold. He was tremendously influential in the state, not only because he was the first professor of game management, but he was also involved in politics, in bringing farmers and hunters and bird watchers together to preserve land.
In the studio with John Hildebrand, the author of Long Way Round Through the Heartland by River, a wonderful book. There are too many to mention here, but you ran into, for the most part, some very hospitable people, and it seemed that all were interesting in their own way. Let me read a paragraph that might set this up a little bit. You had run into some people who had a huge boat called the Bada Bing.
Yeah.
You got to say that in a certain way.
Bada Bing.
Bada Bing. You didn't know, I guess, what to make of them because they had such a huge boat. You got to talking. Here's what you noticed. She was letting me know that she and her friends weren't millionaires, just working stiffs who owned really big boats. In America, the land of brazen consumption, it's always a mistake to size people up based on their possessions. Is the skinny guy wearing patched Carhartts a day laborer or a tenured poet? Is the guy who almost ran you over in a powerboat a raging redneck or the son of Laotian immigrants? Whenever I guessed, I inevitably got it wrong. That would be the one great takeaway from my long roundabout trip, not to guess.
Well, so I do think there are divisions in the state. There are divisions in the whole country. And I think both sides make assumptions about people. Making assumptions about people is another way of saying you have a bias, you know, for or against some folks. And what I found is just people generally were very open to me, very gracious. Willing to lend a hand, willing to lend advice. You know, I think we've allowed politicians to divide us. And in some ways, I think you know, social media has kind of made the situation worse. There are fewer opportunities to get to know strangers. I think we're leery of that.
Yeah. Did you record people or did you just take copious notes or is your memory just that good? Because your conversations, your dialogue in the book is very captivating.
I don't record people because I find that's a
Back
awkward
a
thing to
yeah.
do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would talk to folks and if I thought, okay, here's somebody that I want to maybe include in the book, I would let them know what I was doing. I would take out my notepad and pen. Other times I would just, for instance, anybody that I didn't fully name, what I would probably do is just remember what the conversation was about and then try to record it as soon after I'd had that conversation.
You describe things wonderfully. It's one of those books where because you are so good at describing things and taking the reader there, that one, when he has to put the book down and do something else or wait until the next day because he's falling asleep, he can't wait to get back to it.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that. I'm going to give people one more little example of the way John Hildebrand writes. Night settled in and everything became the sound of itself, a sandhill crane bugling from the darkness and another crane answering, the plucked banjo string of a bullfrog somewhere in a far-off pasture, a cow mooed her sweet good nights. I think that was where you had pulled up on a sandbar, and it might have been late, and it turned out to be wonderful.
Yeah, and not too far from John Muir's homestead. What intruded a little bit on that scene was then I turn on my marine radio,
yes,
and an electronic voice tells me there's going to be a big thunderstorm coming in the morning, and in fact,
there was. I took notes during the book. I loved the fact that you put the word patchouli in your book, being a guy of the 60s and 70s. That's Mazamani. I've never been to the nude beach, but there is one there.
I went past the nude beach. I was expecting a nude beach, and what I saw was a naked beach. People looked cold and goosebumped. And, you know, I think, you know, again, there was sort of divide on how people looked at the nude beach.
Yeah.
It was either, from what I'd heard before, you know, a sign of the depravity of people from Madison, or on the other hand, our openness and
yes,
comfort with our own bodies. You know, take your pick.
I think nudists should have their place.
Well, what I thought interesting is the state was going to close it down, and one of the proposals what to do with it was turn it into a shooting range. And there you go.
Yeah. I love the fact that you call RVs aluminum land yachts. Nostalgia is an ache in the heart for what is unrecoverable. That's a good one. Was it you or someone else drew from the same inkwell of hyperbole?
No, that was a sports writer from the 1920s.
Okay.
He founded the Isaac Walton League.
Oh, yeah.
He also saved the river bottoms of the Mississippi River. And then he got kicked out of the Isaac Walton League. very interesting, kind of tragic story. But we have him to thank for the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife Refuge.
Every photographer should have this on the wall in their studio. Composition is the arrangement of unequal things. That was about Bennett, the photographer.
What you notice if you look at Bennett's photographs, the people are in many ways larger than the landscape. It's kind of a switch from, you know, the romantic photographs, paintings,
yeah,
that depict human beings kind of dwarfed by landscape. Bennett kind of turned it around. You know, I wrote about Bennett because he essentially invented the Dells,
yeah,
invented a narrative to go along with the Dells. And you go on a tour boat, you're hearing essentially the narrative that he dreamed up in the 1880s.
You know, the more I think about it, the more I think black and white photographs do wonders of nature more justice. My first inkling that photographs just don't cut it was when I stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon. Nah, I've seen a lot of photographs, but nothing like this.
That's right. What lens am I going to use?
Yeah, right.
You can't get a wide enough. That's one of the reasons I never include photographs in a book. You're competing with the prose. When you're describing something, usually there's a point you want to make, and the photograph may not make the same point.
And a final quote, neighborhoods are where you find them. That one I really like. Now, the last 2.5 pages of Long Way Around, John Hildebrand, are, in my mind, wonderful, and they describe what you learned. It's like Dorothy when she wakes up from her trip to Oz and she's telling everyone what she learned. I could actually hear music in the background as I read that. It's like at the end of an epic film where, yes, we were entertained, but we also learned something important, and your book is important. I hope it inspires people to give themselves the kinds of experiences that you have made sure you have given yourself over the years.
Well, the subject that I didn't know was going to be the subject when I set off on the trip turned out to be small towns. It turned out to be people living in these small towns, and the way that they have persisted, in many ways prevailed against big odds. You know, most of the economic growth in this country has all been in cities.
Uh-huh.
It's bypassed the countryside, it's bypassed small towns. And in just about every town I went through, I would meet somebody who seemed to be, you know, holding things in place just mm-hmm. almost by sheer will. You know, you wonder, well, why do people stay in a town where there's a lot less economic opportunity, where you got to fight to keep your schools going, where it's a long drive to the hospital, where sometimes even basic services go away. And it isn't inertia, it's love, it's loyalty. I was really impressed with people I met.
I didn't think about this till now. The reasons that many small towns shrivel up is because bureaucrats decide that the highway is going to go somewhere else. However, towns, if you think about it, are built on a body of water, so they should consider themselves very fortunate that they still are located on a beautiful highway.
Yeah. You know, towns were located on rivers because they were the first highways.
Sure, yeah.
And they were engines of commerce for a long time. Now they've sort of been degraded into just scenery. And yet, they're still there. You can still travel from town to town on these waterways. And when you approach a small town, I'm thinking like Durand, from the river, you're seeing it the way the founders imagined that you would see it. Full of promise, full of hope.
So the quest for this book should be to inspire people to use those original highways more often.
Well, I hope so. And if you don't own a canoe, then get in your car and, you know, get off the interstate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Get to know some of these towns up north and out west and in between.
John Hildebrand, Long Way Round, Through the Heartland by River. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Spectrum West on WPR, we'll talk with Susie Boggess, who's singing in Wisconsin in coming days, next. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, dedicated to providing an enjoyable and stress-free buying process for almost 50 years with welcoming facilities and personalized service. Details are at MarquardtToyota.com. Support also comes from UW Eau Claire Artist Series. New York's Aquila Theater presents a modern interpretation of George Orwell's 1984. November 4th at Gantner Concert Hall. UWEC.edu. Susie Boggess is a household name when talking about successful women of music, but she'd like to be known for more than just residing in the country pigeonhole. She dabbles and reworks things to fit that quest for more.
I don't want to be standing here with this ticket for this outbound plane, because I've been here before and somehow this doesn't feel the same. But talk is cheap, so we could talk all night long, and we may never figure out just where your love went wrong. And I don't want to be standing here, and I don't want to be talking here, and I don't really care who's to blame. Cause if love won't fly on its own free will, it's gonna catch that outbound plane.
Sunday evening's audience at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee will get a dose of the songs that have made her famous, but you'll also be treated to a fresh sound that's more intimate and knocks on the doors of other musical genres. I spoke with Susie Boggess earlier in the week.
I bring in everything. The long underwear. I got the down coat. My fuzzy scarf. I'm prepared.
I don't want to sound weird, but what does a female country star wear for long underwear?
There's silk. They go real well under your jeans, and they actually make them kind of slide good. Well, it helps, you know.
Okay. Let's let's forget I asked that.
Fine.
An Illinois girl, the daughter of BJ and Bud, and I already like Bud because I think anybody who had an 8-track player in their vehicle was cool. Homecoming queen in high school. And I have to say, Susie, that one of the coolest things I think about your days here on Earth, at least from my perspective, you got to hang out with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans.
Isn't that cool? I mean, I feel like I've bragging about it all the time. And the funny thing is I really never talked about it in the early days. And Roy was still coming to Nashville, you know, after I had made my mark, you know, so I was seeing him and everything. But I never really thought about making a big point that yeah. I had met him when I was young. He lived out close to my aunt and uncle. So after the ACM Awards out in Los Angeles, I stayed with my aunt. And the next morning, I had won the award for the new female.
Mm-hmm.
We went to the same old place where everybody went for breakfast, and sure. Roy was sitting there, and he said, "So, you're a yodeler."
I know Roy did it. Did Dale yodel, too?
You know, I don't know.
Because I thought maybe you had learned it from Roy, but
he's
yeah,
a good
no.
songwriter. We know that.
Yeah,
you know.
That's true. I sent for, by the way, a CD that teaches you how to yodel while you're driving.
That's how I learned while I was
really?
Driving. You know, I'd have these gigs that I would do in my little camper truck that I bought after mm-hmm. college. I'd go all the way to Montana and Wyoming and that because I had that nomad in me getting out there. And so that was a great time to practice something like that because it keeps you awake for one thing. You know, you're by yourself. Honestly, learning how to yodel, you should not try to do that around other people.
No.
It will
yeah.
off-put them.
It's embarrassing, yeah. So here's another association that you had that I find wonderful, is you got to hang out with Chet Atkins, too.
I did. I know.
Wow.
I mean, I have been very fortunate to hang around and mm-hmm. collaborate with some pretty amazing people. I feel very lucky. You know, as you were saying, my dad's 8-track collection is how I really got to know about country music and became a radio fan as well. But initially it was the 8-tracks of my dad's Dodge
yeah.
Polara.
That's cool. That is so cool. You have a reverence strong for Merle Haggard, the stuff he sang about and how he sang it, enough so that you are the female with the guts to do his songs your way. You are quoted as saying, "I miss that fearlessness today." So is the album Lucky a reminder that we can indeed be fearless in our songwriting nowadays?
I think so. I do hear people from time to time that I think have, that still got that chestnut in there, you know, that style of writing. But there is a lot of playing it safe here in Nashville right now. And there's a lot of us that, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek talk about the catchphrases, you know, all about the tailgate and
that's right.
the beer in your car. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not PC anymore. You can't say you got a beer in the glove box or whatever.
I was a lot more into country back in the 80s and 90s than I am today. In fact, I don't listen because to me, and this is just an aside, I may edit it out. Who knows? I may just have the guts to leave it in.
You might just be fearless.
Yeah, that's me. Especially the guys out there that I'm listening to. Most of it that makes it on the radio sounds way too boilerplated to me. But then
yeah.
again, there are so many listening outlets out there now that maybe I could, if I search long enough, find a token of the good stuff somewhere other than the hot country charts, as they call them.
You know, I don't have any problem with people talking about, you know, back roads and bonfires and stuff like that, because I know I'm from a small town in Illinois. I know it still goes on.
Yeah.
What I have a problem with is people who don't actually know anything about that lifestyle
yeah.
and drive a Prius, but they they want to talk about their pickup truck that they don't even have.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Here's the true testament to the Haggard stuff. If you can write a song or write songs that get the following labels, and these are song descriptions of Haggard songs: boozy, randy, I love that, and
that's great.
And somber.
Yeah.
If you can write songs that get those kind of descriptions, then you're in that league.
Well, I don't know where that came from, but that's brilliant. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. And not just somber, but also personal. His songs, you know, when I got into choosing which songs I was going to sing, you know, I literally didn't have to change words, even though I'm a different gender, because they were so personal. They were just about persons,
mm-hmm.
and they were just really, really, really universal.
Well, congratulations on doing that. I think that's that's very cool. And I think he'd be, well, you think he'd be happy, huh?
He was happy. He, actually, he was still around when that album came out.
Oh, he was? Okay.
He called me. The thing he got the biggest kick out of was me singing, "I Think I'll Just Stay Here and Drink." He just thought that was really brave of me to do that song. And I just said, well,
yeah,
I've been there. Yeah. I've been in that. I've been in a fight with my own dang husband. Just said, you know, go home. I'm sitting here with my friends.
That's the voice of Susie Boggess, and she is appearing in some Wisconsin locations, including the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, the very beautiful Mabel Tainter. Have you been there?
I have not, but I've been hearing about it for a really long time. Garrison Keillor told me about it, and his cousin lives over there, and he's the one who's kind of been championing for me, because I, you know, it's really hard sometimes to just squeeze different things into your schedule because you might be in Florida or Texas or someplace else. And so it just so happened that I already had two shows in Wisconsin booked, and this worked out great that they would do it Sunday for me.
Very cool. Yeah, it's Sunday evening, 7:30. MabelTainter.org is the website, by the way, and you're also appearing in Stoughton down in southern Wisconsin. And the Park Center up in Hayward, which is way up there. Aces Redux, re-recording of your platinum album from 91. It's described as having, quote-unquote, fresh arrangements. So I'm curious as to what else went through your mind during the process of making this album happen, because some would say that it's a bit risky to redo the ultimate. As the saying goes, if it ain't broke, don't break it.
Yeah.
What did you think you could do for the album from this vantage point in your life? And maybe that was it. Maybe you wanted this vantage point to come through.
Well, here's one thing. I mean, some of the songs on the album have really deepened in meaning for me as time has gone on. Some of them that are, you know, were about relationships, and, you know, one in particular, the song Letting Go, my husband wrote that song for my mom and I. And when I sang it, I didn't have a child. You know, I was only singing it from the young girl that was going away and leaving her mother and going to be missing her mom. But when I sang it after that, my son was in college. You know, I knew how it felt to, you know, see that there was a time when he was going to be moving away. When I sang it that time, I feel like I had so much more knowledge and so much more feeling for the song, even though it was very meaningful to me when I sang it from the girl's standpoint. It's about a mother and a daughter, the daughter reaching 18 and getting ready to go away to college. It's very moving and sad. You know, that happens to everybody when their kids grow up. They move on.
Sure.
And you want them to, but at the same time, there's just that bittersweet.
She'll take the painting in the hallway, the one she did.
So when you redo these songs, you're in the control room and you're listening back to it. Are you listening for that feel, the Susie today?
Yeah. Also just I try really hard when I'm performing live, you know, to not do the autopilot thing, you know?
Good. Yeah.
You know, because even though you've sung a song a lot of times, it doesn't mean that you can't feel it each time. I mean, actors are very good at, you know, creating the characters and, you know, and staying with that. And that's what I try to do, is I have a lot of stories that play through my mind when I'm singing the song. And so I wanted to make sure that that was all still in there.
Cool.
And I also wanted to make sure the signature licks were in there, because being a fan myself, I love it when I go to hear somebody and they start out a song with this intro or whatever that just takes me back to a certain time in my life, wherever I was when I first heard the song, or whenever it really dawned on me how much I appreciated the song.
Sure.
And
yeah.
So I didn't want to take any of that away. But, you know, I travel with an acoustic trio now. three-part harmony and upright bass, and so I wanted folks to be able to take home something that was more representative of what they see at the show.
You are described as, quote, one of country music's most pristine and evocative vocalists. You're like a national park that deserves preserving. You're pristine. That's good for you.
Pristine. On a good day, maybe.
Well, that's cool. You brought up the trio. In recent years, some of your musical dabbling has been given the jazz label. Proof of that might be the fact that you're playing the Dakota in Minneapolis, where, I got to tell you, lots of jazzers hang out and they riff. What are we going to see and hear at your Wisconsin performances?
Yeah, well, you know, I always do the hits. They were the ones that brought me to the show, and I don't want to let people down. Mm-hmm. And then I do a couple of the Merle songs. I do a couple of songs from my American Folk Songbook album. Then pulling out some little gems from my archive that, you know, were collaborations, like doing something with Chet. There's a song that I did with Kathy Mattea and Alison Krauss that we've been doing lately. And we do a little bit of swing. I made a swing album, and then I made an album that was a little more jazzy. More like a James Taylor jazz, you know, kind of a pop jazz. So we try to just pull a little bit of everything out there.
I have to tell you, it's good to talk with you. I'm a fan. And in parting, here's my advice. Keep making music mean something, will you?
We
need that.
I keep my show pretty happy these days.
I say, how can you not be happy when you're wearing silk long underwear?
Exactly true. That's the joy of it.
That's wonderful. Susie Bogus, thanks for being with us on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you, Al.
Sunday night, Mabel Tainter, Center for the Arts, Menominee, MabelTainter.org. That's where your tickets are waiting, folks. Hey, time for some Spectrum Memos. Saturday, Kevin McMullen brings his Into the Black Sea, Stories of Darkness and Light show to the West Denmark Parish Hall, 7:30 p.m. If you missed it in Eau Claire, here's your chance. Just head over to Luck, Wisconsin, okay? UW Stout presents a Wednesday, November 6th concert in the Great Hall of the Memorial Student Center featuring the music of top 10 artist Nash with opening act Emily Brandt. Doors open at 7. The Theater and Music Department at Memorial High School in Eau Claire presents Shrek the Musical Friday night plus Saturday and Sunday afternoons, November 8th through 10th in the Memorial High School Auditorium. Tickets at the door. The Menominee Art Music Society presents Two for the Show Friday at Our Savior's Lutheran Church. That's on 9th Street Southeast in Menominee. Thanks to Dean and Kate, as usual, for being there. Next week, one of my favorites, Pat Donahue, pays us a visit. We'll hear some tunage from him. Award-winning author and illustrator Eliza Wheeler, who hails from around these parts, will be here. Artists Anders Schaefer and Ed Erdman talk about their inclusion in a big show. And Jim Oliver welcomes director Blaine Halverson. Hey, thanks for the treats. Have a safe Halloween. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. See you next week.